Good morning, everyone. I will call the Commerce, Finance, and Policy meeting to order for April 9th. There is a quorum present. First item of business is approval of the minutes. Chair O'Driscoll, have you had a chance to take a look at the minutes from April 7th?
Madam Chair, I move approval of the April 7th minutes.
Chair O'Driscoll moves approval of the minutes for Tuesday, April 7th, 2026. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion, all those opposed? Motion prevails. Very engaged today. All right, first up on the agenda is Representative Cherokee of Wattoon with House File 1758. And the bill, we have House File 1758 before us with the intent to lay the bill over. Good morning, Representative Katiza Wattoon. I understand you have an A2 author's amendment. Would you like to move and explain your amendment, please?
Madam Chair, the A2 author's amendment just fixes the dates that are included in the bill. This bill was originally drafted and referred to Commerce last year. Of course, we didn't get a hearing last year, so this just puts everything in alignment for moving forward.
All right. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. All right. And then are we going to explain the bill first and then move to amendments? Or?
Actually, Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I would like to move the A4 amendment
okay.
as well.
Wonderful. So A4, Representative Patiz Wattoon.
Members, the A4 author's amendment is a religious freedom exemption that Senator McQuaid and I included in this year's version of this bill because of the contracted timetable that we're working on and delays in the revisor's office. That bill was sent to health. It is a bill that was heard in the health committee yesterday. It includes this religious exemption text, and so we are just bringing this language into 1758 to make sure that the bills match.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. The A4 is adopted. All right, bill presentation. Representative Katiza Wattoon, would you like to explain your bill as amended?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I very much appreciate you agreeing to hear House File 1758. Excuse me. The Minnesota Building Families Act. The Minnesota Building Families Act is a simple bill with a huge impact. It would just require insurance companies to cover the cost of infertility diagnosis and treatments. We know that many, many Minnesotans are waiting and excited to grow their families, but cannot because their health insurance does not cover diagnosis or treatment of infertility. Many families end up cashing out 401ks, paying penalties, taking second mortgages on their homes, maxing out credit cards, and even having bake sales to be able to afford this treatment and have a child. Extreme financial stress is not the way that any family should be welcoming their child into the world, and the Building Families Act would lower cost sharing and provide access to infertility diagnosis and treatment for the 1 in 7 couples here in Minnesota dealing with infertility. This bill was originally introduced by Jamie Long in 2020, I believe, and so for the last 8 years, I've had members of the public coming to me and sharing their support for this bill. I've got a number of constituents who have shared their personal stories, and I'm really proud that in the Senate, this bill is bipartisan, and I have had multiple conversations with members of this committee and others on the Republican side of the aisle who are interested in moving forward with some changes and getting to a workable place to ensure that Minnesotans can start a family when they want to. Over the last few weeks, I just want to clarify, because I think a lot of you have had some conversations with different advocates, there's been some confusion about what this bill does and what it does not do. And so there are a number of varying opinions about surrogacy, and that's, you know, obviously here at the legislature, but also across the state. The Minnesota Building Families Act does not change anything about the way that surrogacy currently operates in the state of Minnesota. A person's insurance covers their own individual medical care, and the Minnesota Building Families Act would cover an individual's diagnosis and treatment of infertility, period. Surrogates, by definition, are not people who are experiencing infertility because they can be pregnant and carry a birth to term. Language in this bill about third parties exists because not every person or couple who uses assisted reproductive technology to become a parent does so with their own genetic material. Without that third-party language, insurance companies would have to deny or likely deny infertility treatment to couples who intend to donate their embryos after completing their family, or deny couples coverage if they are getting pregnant with a donated embryo. In addition to, in my opinion, that being entirely unacceptable, it would also be unworkable to ask insurance companies to determine every person or couple's intent with their embryos after they complete their family. Surrogacy is happening here in Minnesota, but instead of being regulated through state law, it is handled with contracts and lawyers, and health insurance coverage for health care treatments cannot pay for contracts and lawyers for other people. Members, extending insurance coverage to cover a medical diagnosis and treatment of infertility is a logical thing to do, and it's also the right thing to do. I know that we're laying this bill over today. I am continuing conversations with both advocates and members, with folks in the other body, and we are just very interested in supporting those people and couples who are struggling to grow or start their family. If here in Minnesota we want to be the best state to raise a family, we have to be the best state to start a family. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And with that, we will move to testifiers. First up is Myra Gran from the Minnesota Building Families Association, and then Annie Marie McDonald will be on deck. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, and members of the committee. My name is Mariah Gran, and I am here as president of the Minnesota Building Families Association. I'm also a patient advocate. Before I begin, I'd like to propose some hypothetical questions to the committee. If you are a parent, or hope to be, how much of your financial future would you risk for your child? Now I want you to imagine yourself sitting at your kitchen table, surrounded by medical bills. Your heart is heavy, and every day you wonder how you will make ends meet. You ask yourself, at what point would I be forced to give up? And in that moment, giving up would mean the devastating reality of never getting the chance to meet your child, the child you dreamed of, the child you fought for. This isn't hypothetical for many Minnesotans. It's a reality. In Minnesota, 1 in 6 experience infertility, more than 186,000 people. Half of them are men, and half of them are women. Nearly 10% of cancer patients, about 8,000 Minnesotans, may need fertility preservation to build a family. I've faced infertility for over a decade, 7 miscarriages, 2 rounds of IVF, out-of-pocket costs due to lack of insurance coverage. My husband and I took out a second mortgage and used some of our retirement savings to have our daughter, who just turned 5 last month. We still have 2 embryos left, but without insurance coverage, we can't afford to add to our family. My story is not unique. Without fertility insurance, families drain savings, max out credit cards, and take out second mortgages, all to chase the dream of parenthood. The emotional and financial toll is overwhelming. House File 1758 offers the solution. Studies show that when insurance covers IVF, health outcomes improve for mothers and babies, and health care costs go down. In the 25 other states across this country that have passed fertility coverage laws, there has been little impact on insurance premiums. A 2021 Mercer study of over 450 employers found that 97% of employers offering fertility coverage, including IVF, saw no significant increase in medical costs. Many of the larger Minnesota corporations, such as General Mills and 3M, carry this for their employees. This bill would help smaller businesses in competing with larger businesses by offering competitive health insurance coverage. Fertility coverage doesn't just save families and businesses financially, it saves lives too. Patients are more likely to choose single embryo transfer, reducing high-risk pregnancies and costly NICU stays for insurance companies. A recent study by the Women's Health Research and Action Center shows 65% of Americans support mandatory insurance coverage for fertility treatments. Even legislators such as yourself have fertility insurance coverage. The families you represent deserve the same access. Without fertility insurance, families must pay out of pocket for care that insurers have the ability to negotiate at a lower rate. The burden falls entirely on families, not on the insurers who benefit. You will hear from the opposition today that infertility can be cured by treating root causes instead of IVF. But patients who pursue IVF like myself, have already explored and addressed those causes and determined that IVF is the appropriate treatment for them. Suggesting otherwise ignores the complexity of infertility, undermines the patient, and excludes people such as cancer patients. Today we stand united, patients, providers, employers, some of them here wearing orange today, demanding action on this bill. This bill is pro-family, bipartisan, and ready to pass. So I asked you earlier, how much would you risk for your child? Perhaps your children or grandchildren will face this question one day. House File 1758 gives you the chance to act now so they never have to ask, how much of my financial future will I risk to become a parent? Please pass House File 1758 and give hardworking Minnesota families like mine the reprieve they desperately need. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up is Anna Marie McDonald, followed by Dr. April Batchelor. And I believe Ms. McDonald is online. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and state your guest's name for the record, too, that'd be wonderful.
Yes. Hi, my name is Anna Marie McDonald, and this is Charlotte McDonald.
Wonderful. Proceed with your testimony, please.
Good morning, Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, and committee members. My name is Anna Marie McDonald, and I'm a proud citizen of the state of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to hear my story today. My husband and I always knew we wanted to start a family as soon as we were married, but after 6 months of trying without success, we realized we needed help. The moment infertility was added to our medical file, we lost insurance coverage for fertility treatment entirely. Our attempting less invasive treatments and continuing to work closely with our doctors, we came to understand that IVF was our only real path to becoming parents. Despite having good jobs and doing everything we were supposed to do, our insurance covered none of it. Our clinic offered a program to help with costs, but it required a large upfront payment. And in September 2024, we made the incredibly difficult decision to take out a second mortgage on our home to afford treatment. At a time when we were already facing the emotional toll of infertility, we were also asked to risk our financial future for just the chance to have a child. Just over 2 weeks ago, our daughter Charlotte was born through IVF, and she's everything we dreamed of. We are overwhelmed with love and gratitude for her and for the journey that brought her to us.
Thank you so much.
That joy exists alongside a very real financial burden. Because of the second mortgage, we will take a significant loss when we eventually sell our home, limiting our ability to move, even though we now need more space for our growing family. We're caught between the cost of where we live and the cost of how we became a family. We also hope to have more children. We have 4 embryos remaining, but each transfer comes with a significant cost. Now, with a newborn at home, we're trying to plan for the future while simply staying afloat. The financial pressure touches every part of our lives. We didn't just hope to become parents, we sacrificed and invested everything to make it possible. The lack of fertility coverage has shaped where we can live, how many children we can have, and what our future looks like. These are life-defining decisions, and right now, our options feel painfully limited. Please give hardworking Minnesotans like my husband and me a fair chance to build our families. I urge you to pass the Minnesota Building Families Act so that others don't have to face the same impossible choices that we do. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and congratulations.
Thank you. Beautiful.
Thank you. Next up is April Batchelor, and then followed by Dan Andreessen. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, and thank you, Chairs Cagle and O'Driscoll, members of the committee. My name is Dr. April Batchelor. I'm a reproductive endocrinologist and serve as medical director at CCRM Minneapolis and Edina, and professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity today to testify in support of HF 1758, which would expand infertility insurance coverage for Minnesotans. As a physician, my responsibility is to provide patients with safe, evidence-based care. But too often, the lack of insurance coverage prevents me from doing exactly that. Instead of being guided by best medical practices, treatment decisions are often dictated by what a patient can afford, resulting in delayed care or the pursuit of less effective and higher risk options because they're financially attainable. Infertility is not rare, and it is not elective. It affects 1 in 6 individuals, and every major medical association recognizes this as a disease. Yet despite consensus, nearly half of patients who require advanced treatments such as in vitro fertilization are unable to access due to lack of insurance coverage. This creates profound inequities where the ability to build a family depends not on medical need, but on financial means. When patients cannot afford recommended care, they often feel forced into less expensive, higher risk treatment options. For example, pursuing injectable ovulation induction medications combined with intrauterine insemination, or transferring multiple embryos during IVF to increase the chance of success in a single attempt. Unfortunately, these strategies increase the likelihood of higher order multiple gestation, which carry elevated risks for mothers and babies, including premature birth and long-term health complications, requiring and causing substantially higher healthcare costs. Insurance coverage changes these decisions. When patients feel supported, they are more likely to choose safer, evidence-based approaches that prioritize the health and the mother and child while reducing costly complications. In closing, infertility is a common and serious medical condition that carries emotional, physical, and financial consequences. Expanding insurance coverage will reduce disparities, improve outcomes, and lower overall costs by reducing high-risk pregnancies. I urge you to support HF 1758. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much. Next up, Dan Andreessen, followed by Rebecca Della Hunt. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Just want to get a couple things on the record regarding Costafrail. When this was discussed yesterday in House Health, there was some confusion as to how this would all work. So just wanted to get this in front of the committee. So Commerce has already determined that this mandate is eligible for Costafrail under requirements under the ACA. Mm-hmm. And so the individual market and small group market would get defrail costs for this. Therefore, the state is paying for the cost of this mandate in those two markets. However, there won't be defrayal costs for the large group market. And so when you look at your fiscal notes and it shows defrayal costs, that'll be for the individual market and small group, not the large group. And so the costs won't be fall on the state for that market, but it will fall onto the employers and employees in that market. And there will be a cost to this. The way that the bill is written right now, there is no upper limit to the mandate that, or to the benefits that are being covered. And as mentioned, it's a very costly procedure, and that's because of what providers charge for these services. Also want to just mention regarding the defrayal costs in the individual and small group markets, what you'll see in the fiscal note is just an estimation of what that defrayal cost would be to the state. There is no cap on how much the state would pay for this. There's no direct appropriation like you would see in other programs for other bills. So in 2023, there was a fiscal note that showed that defrayal costs could be around $18 million a year. We heard that there's another fiscal note in the works for this bill, which might be different. But just want to let you know that just kind of keep in mind that the number is just an estimation. Whatever the cost is what the state would have to pay. And so, for example, using that $18 million estimation, if it was the claims that came in were verified, that's what the services cost. It was directly $18 million, that's what the state would pay. If it was less than that, let's say it was $10 million, that's what the state would pay. But if it was more than that, let's say $20, $25 million, the state would have to pay that amount. I'm not aware that this is tracked right now, in large part because up until a few years ago, most of the mandates that are on in-state law don't have cost defrayal associated with them. The only one that was on the books was for a rare disease, and there was probably no claims associated with that cost. But as we enact more mandates that are for services that people are going to be using and there's a cost defrayal portion to it, we probably at some point need to track what this cost would be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up is Rebecca Della Hunt, followed by Maggie Hange. Welcome to the committee. If you just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, co-chairs Cagle and O'Driscoll and members of the committee. Thank you so much for having me today. My name is Rebecca Della Hunt, and I work as Director of Public Policy with Minnesota Family Council. HF 1758 would mandate all health plans in Minnesota cover assisted reproduction services. This includes in vitro fertilization and third-party services. Infertility impacts many Minnesotans, and this is a heartbreaking journey for many. It's impacted likely many in this room and certainly many people we love. We appreciate Rep. Katiza Watoon shared this bill does not include surrogacy, but our interpretation of the language is that we see this bill as potentially interpreting, being interpreted in the future to include surrogacy coverage. I see there's an A2 to remove lines 3.7 and 3.8. It's not been accepted. Line 3.7 and 3.8 prohibit any restriction on any fertility services provided by or to a third party, and the definition of infertility includes inability to conceive as an individual on lines 2.3 and 2.4. Member in another committee called this a straw man argument, but the language of the bill, we believe, could be interpreted to include surrogacy coverage. In surrogacy, eggs and sperm are sourced either from the person or people who will raise the child, called the intended parents, or purchased from a donor. Eggs and sperm are fertilized into multiple embryonic lives, and one is often selected for implantation based on quality and other characteristics. The gestational carrier, the woman carrying the baby, will hand over the baby immediately upon birth to the IPs. Most surrogacy arrangements are paid, meaning that the surrogate is paid for renting her body, and she must follow contractual requirements on medication, diet, lifestyle, etc. Surrogacy always involves intentional stripping of a child from the only mother the baby has known, which is a serious injustice to those children. Though surrogacy agencies may require a background check of IPs, there is no federal or Minnesota law requiring one. Surrogacy costs vary, but after compensation, agency fees, IVF embryo creation and transfer, legal fees, and other costs, costs can be $100,000 to $200,000. Taxpayer-funded insurance should not pay for the intentional separation of children from the only mother the baby has known. That's not good public policy making. Surrogacy is not protected in Minnesota statute, and we argue that it should not be, but it is notable that this bill could mandate insurance coverage of an extra statutory practice. Thank you. Please vote no.
Thank you. Next up, Maggie Hennigy, followed by Renee Oaks. Is that? Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, and members of the committee. My name is Maggie Hange, and I'm the Assistant Director for Family Policy at the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. We're speaking today in opposition to House File 1758 and ask you to vote no. When a couple is eager to start their family, but month after month sees a negative pregnancy test, the reality is devastating. They carry a heavy burden, and we have great compassion for their circumstances. It's out of that compassion that we're called to help these couples with the best tools possible. That is not through pushing expensive and ethically questionable treatments like IVF, but rather by finding and treating the root cause of infertility through restorative reproductive medicine. To truly help couples struggling with infertility, a more effective approach is by promoting and covering restorative reproductive medicine. House File 4154, for example, would increase educational resources around RRM for patients and providers. If the issue is left undetected and a couple happens to get around it through IVF, that couple may have to again employ IVF to continue growing their family, or they may end up with more embryos than they anticipated, leaving them with another ethical dilemma. Do they leave their children on ice indefinitely, discard them, donate them to science, or continue to trying to implant them if they can afford that? Some reports say that up to 90% of embryos created are never born. Undergoing IVF comes at a high financial cost as well. One cycle averages between $15,000 to $30,000, and most couples endure multiple cycles before achieving a successful pregnancy. This would certainly impact our healthcare premiums and come at a cost to the state. Minnesota taxpayers should not be forced to fund this unethical and often ineffective practice. We are grateful, however, that a religious exemption was added so that religious organizations do not have to offer this in their health plans. While proponents have tried to say otherwise, this bill would allow for taxpayer funding of commercial surrogacy. A single male who would be considered infertile under the definition of this bill cannot reproduce without a surrogate who will carry his baby. In practice, surrogacy creates a marketplace where wombs become commodities and children become products. We should certainly not be funding this practice without properly vetting that through the legislative process. Couples deserve better than being funneled down the assisted reproductive path. They deserve real answers. Restorative reproductive medicine can provide those. IVF cannot. Please vote no. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Renee Oakes.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, and members of the committee. My name is Renee Oakes. I'm a fertility care practitioner and the owner and founder of Integrated Fertility Care Center in Stillwater, Minnesota. I speak today in opposition of House File 1758, and I urge you to vote no. I understand well the devastation of infertility, but I also know there is hope for the vast majority of couples. My husband and I have struggled through 24 years of both male and female factor infertility and the loss of five of our babies through recurrent miscarriage. Our success came only after thorough treatment of our health through restorative reproductive medicine from a Napro Technology-trained OBGYN and reproductive endocrinologist. For example, I underwent laparoscopic treatment of endometriosis, treatment for hormone dysfunction and hyperthyroidism, among many other treatments, including those for my husband. We now have three children. Driven by my personal experience and desire to help other couples who were struggling to conceive and or carry to term, I founded Integrated Fertility Care Center. I have worked with hundreds of cases who, even after multiple failed rounds of IVF, received proper treatment and went on to conceive and carry to term not just one, but several babies. I have worked with the hardest cases of those who have tried everything, examples of which are women who were post-cancer treatment and had a stem cell transplant, and many couples who have experienced 10-plus years of infertility and multiple failed rounds of IVF. The common denominator, just as in my own case, were the same set of treatable health concerns. Infertility and recurrent miscarriage are symptoms of a disease, not a disease in and of itself. The desire to help couples experiencing this difficulty is necessary, but IVF seeks not to restore health and fertility, but to circumvent it at a tremendous financial and societal cost. We need to look not only at the high cost of the individual round of IVF, but additionally at the lifelong healthcare cost of not treating the underlying health issues. For example, deep infiltrating endometriosis, which is a leading cause of infertility, comes with an almost tenfold increase in ovarian cancer risk, according to a 2024 study. Those who experience infertility need treatment not only to conceive and carry their children to term, but also for their own lifelong health. The human body is made for procreation, and when thorough medical treatment is sought, healthy babies result. There is great hope with affordable restorative reproductive medicine. I urge you to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Oakes, if you could just stay up there. We do have one question from the committee. I just want to ask if there are any other members of the public wishing to testify. Seeing none, then we will move on to member discussion. Representative Smith.
Thank you. And I do have a question for the testifier, because you mentioned several treatments, endometriosis, hypothyroidism. This is about if insurance should cover things like that. Those particular things, you can tell from either your experience as a provider or your experience receiving them, were they covered by insurance?
Yes, they are.
Ms. Oakes. Representative Smith.
So for me, that would say that it's good for insurance to cover treatments that help with fertility, which is exactly what this bill will do. That's my
Thank
question.
Thank you. All right. Representative Hewitt, is this question to Ms. Oakes or?
No, to the general. Are we done with, are we in?
We're done with testifiers, yes.
Yeah, I'd like to get to the general.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, if I could have the doctor or Rachel, Battles come back up. And we heard this bill yesterday and health, and I do want to thank the Catholic Conference for getting me the data. However, I'm still having trouble with that data because Minnesota Health Department doesn't track any of these numbers that we're beginning here. It's not a requirement of them to do that. So that's pretty interesting when we hear nice round numbers and we don't get Minnesota hard stuff. But doctor, can I ask you a question? Is there a thing called the triple test?
Dr. Batchelor?
Test. Sorry. First, I just want to say my name is Dr. April Batchelor. For some reason, everyone wants to call me Rachel, but it is April, like the month. and secondly, you know, I would just be curious what you mean by the triple test. You know, that isn't, I'm sure I can speak to it, but I just want to understand exactly what it is that you're asking.
Representative
Madam Chair, Doctor, yeah, I'm just asking this for a question because I know my wife and I, 30-some years ago when we started the family, it was highly recommended we do this triple test that was, and I'm going to speak out here because I want to save time for the committee, was recommended that we do, and it also was covered by our insurance company. Would that all be fair to say?
Dr. Batchelor?
Yes. Oh, yes. Thank you. What I'd like to just describe is that the usual practice in which we work a patient up, because I have to say that I couldn't agree more with Ms. Hange with regards to the need to investigate the ability to restore fertility. But in fact, that's something that reproductive endocrinologists always lead with. You know, when I see a new patient, the very first thing we do is take a thorough medical history, and we ask, you know, what medical problems do you have? Are they optimized? Is your weight healthy? Do you have undiagnosed type 2 diabetes? Do you have a thyroid disorder? We go through the whole gamut, and of course, the very first thing that we want to ensure is that that patient is thoroughly, you know, teed up and in the healthiest possible place to pursue pregnancy. That's the very first thing we do. And then the next thing that we do is go through all the component parts that are needed to produce a pregnancy. We want to know what's the ovarian function. We assess this with an ultrasound. We assess this with hormones. Is there an imbalance? Can we improve that? What is the status of the structural piece of the uterus? You know, is there a fibroid? Is there a polyp? We do something called a hysterosampigogram, an HSG, where we assess tubal patency. Is there a surgical solution to that? We look inside the uterus with a hysteroscope, which means I literally video going into the uterus, video the inside of the uterus. Is there something in there that we can improve? If yes, that's the very first thing we do. We do a semen analysis to take a look at the partner's sperm. Is there a problem with the sperm? Do we need to refer them to a reproductive urologist, which is a specialty like my own, but for men? All of that is the very first step when we see a patient. And if there is something to be fixed, absolutely, that's what we want to do. And so, you know, I think that it's unfair to suggest that the very first thing we do is is discuss IVF. And in fact, I have to say that we are extraordinarily proud of the very thorough work that we do when we intake a patient and the nuances and the care that's taken there. And oftentimes I'll tell patients, you know, for better or for worse in the health system, sometimes you have to see a subspecialist in order to be, you know, directed to places that can actually improve your health. I diagnose diabetes and hypertension, thyroid disorders daily. You know, so I'm not sure if that's what you mean with regards to the triple test, but I do want to just describe that is our typical practice when we see any patient.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Doctor. It actually is not where I wanted to go, but I can go there.
Okay.
You opened the door. So a triple test simply is a test they gave about 35 years ago. And that triple test came back to my wife and I saying that our child may have complicated problems, and it was just a simple blood test. And before it was given, naturally they said the insurance company will pay for this and all this other rigmarole. Working in EMS, and my largest number of transports were neonatal children from around the state, I know that a neonate or a child with complications is going to cost an insurance company a lot more money. It's a lot more to the bottom line. In fact, there's historical statements saying that twins that were neonatal made the bottom line change on one of our major insurance companies. You can see why this would be to their benefit to support something like this. Why are they supporting a triple test and not this? This is my question, and it's more of a statement in a philosophical way, is that I would think that the insurance companies would be good with this if they can support things that are going to save their bottom line. Well, we don't have our insurance companies are nonprofit in the state, I hope, for the most part, sorry. I like it that when they prosper, I like it when they actually do well, but cutting out stuff like this when people are in really, I'm glad I'm over those days, but to worry if they're going to be able to start a family and not be willing to support that is just bothersome, but they'll be willing to support the front end of saying, well, maybe you should really consider what you're getting into here and things like that. And again, I appreciate the doctor and how she went through those tests that, again, they're willing to cover all that so we know what we're getting into. But realistically, shouldn't they help us with the whole picture here? And that's where I'm having trouble. And again, for me, the data on this that we're hearing testifiers from come up with it, I mean, I have to give my colleagues from across the aisle, they sent me some data overnight, which I appreciate when they do that. But even that data was from Europe. I want Minnesota data. I want to know what, because that's who we govern. We don't govern the country. We govern Minnesota. And so I think the data is kind of extracted here from pick and choose what you want. So Representative Carly, I really appreciate you bringing this bill. I think it's time to help our families any way we can and move forward with this bill. This is an important bill for families in Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dotson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the author, question I've got, I guess a statement I'll start with is I've actually witnessed this process firsthand. So I understand the benefit and the great miracle that can take place with this. Going through this without insurance is traumatic. But the question I would have for the author is, would you consider putting a cap on this so there's a limit of how much can actually be spent in this process?
Representative Katisa Batu.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We would consider a cap. So in line 2.19, there is flexibility to impose a limit of 4 completed oocyte retrievals. And so that's what we have in the bill at this point in time. It does include unlimited embryo transfers, but I think then that's something that we would be willing to discuss.
Representative Dotson?
I look forward to having further discussion with you on this, but a question I might have for Dr. April or Dr. Renee, and Dr. Renee, I value your process as well. I think it's incredible what she does there. But the concern I've got is, why is this process so blasted expensive? It doesn't make sense for this to cost so much.
Yeah.
Dr. Batchelor?
Yes. Sorry. Thank you.
You're fine.
So the reason that it becomes very expensive is because it takes a village, you know. So when we do the in vitro process, essentially what in vitro means is outside of the body. And so what we do in the IVF lab is try to recreate the human body in a lab, which of course is impossible, you know. But what is required of that is an operating room in which the eggs are extracted. It requires a team of embryologists, who are our scientists, who have either a bachelor's of science or a PhD in the lab. And then those scientists take the eggs and oftentimes use what's called micromanipulation techniques, where they inject one sperm under a microscope using a very fancy and expensive, unfortunately, microscope. It's on a stabilization table so that it doesn't move at all, because everything is so precise that even like somebody walking down the hall will jiggle the table, and it's very difficult to even get the sperm into the egg. And so that equipment is enormously expensive. The culture media is designed to mimic what's in the fallopian tubes and what's in the uterus, and it's constantly being improved and investigated, because of course it's not perfect, and we're really trying as best we can to mimic what's in the body. And so that science and investigation is enormously expensive. The IVF lab is in a negative pressure situation because the embryos are meant to be in a perfect environment. And of course, we're trying to recreate that. And so the lab is a clean place. It requires triple gas incubators in order to create, you know, intra-body carbon dioxide, oxygen, nitrogen concentrations. And just all of that personnel and technical equipment, it comes with an enormous cost, both, you know, setup, ongoing maintenance, improvement as technology advances. That's where the majority of the cost comes in.
Representative Katisa-Toon.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And with all of that, I think it's really important to consider that medical care is expensive. We talked about in many different veins here in this committee, but other procedures are covered by insurance. So insurance companies can negotiate a lower rate. For example, a C-section, the average cost of a C-section is $42,000. That's more than a round of IVF. Mm-hmm. A knee replacement costs more than a round of IVF. Those treatments are covered by insurance. So it's not more than any other medical care. It's just that people are paying out of pocket. So we are feeling the cost of it versus being able to, you know, obtain insurance that insurance companies then can negotiate lower rates for with the providers.
Representative Dotsoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a final statement. I would just hope that the village can somehow figure out a way where we can actually wrap arms around us and help get the expense down, because I think the village can figure out a way to achieve that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Katiza-Watoon for your bill. I support this bill. One way that I agree with Donald Trump is that I think we really need to have universal access to IVF for those who want it. And I just want to respond to some of the opposition testimony that we heard. I have a question for Dr. Batchelor. Is there a way to cure infertility for lesbian couples?
Dr. Batchelor?
Yes. You know, I think that in terms of curing infertility, I would say there's certainly a way of treating successfully, you know, infertility for all couples. So for our lesbian couples, of course, what we have is a male factor where we don't have sperm, you know, and in order for them to achieve a pregnancy, they need to use a sperm donor. And that donor can be in, you know, sourced from a number of different directions. It could be someone that they know and have a personal connection with. It could be also an anonymous sperm donor. As a physician, our job is to make sure that that donor is safe, and this is one of the reasons that I think it's really important that, for example, our lesbian patients have access to care, in that we need to make sure that that sperm source, wherever that sperm source may be, is free of infectious disease, you know, has been thoroughly vetted from a background check perspective. It needs, you know, they need to have a legal contract in place if it's something that there's a co-parenting arrangement. And my job as a physician is basically to quarterback all that and just really make sure that all of our patients are making safe and healthy decisions. And I think making sure that they have access to that treatment is mission critical, because otherwise, you know, this would be something that we wouldn't want folks trying to access without, you know, medical vetting, in my opinion.
Representative Finke.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that answer, Doctor. In 23, when we talked about this bill, a member of the House told me essentially that the turkey baster method was working just fine.
Yeah.
And we need to recognize what we're trying to do here and how discrimination is illegal in Minnesota. So I appreciate your work. I appreciate all of your work. And yeah, let's support Donald Trump's executive order and get IVF into the hands of families who want children.
Thank you. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank the last testifier that spoke. I appreciate her comments here this morning. And I to the bill's author, I know we had a little dust up yesterday in health in regards to cost. And, you know, I thought a little bit about our conversation and about this bill. I still need some more clarification on cost. It's hard for me to grasp, but you can come to this committee yesterday and today without some really hard fiscal numbers. It looks like to me your fiscal numbers are estimates based off of some old evidence. Can you enlighten us a little more about what this is going to cost? Who's going to pay for this bill? Is it the taxpayer that's paying this bill? Or is it insurance companies going to pay the bill?
Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that question, Representative Van Binsbergen. So the public programs portion of this that we discussed yesterday in health comes out of the general fund and the healthcare access fund. Taxes are collected. That's how we gather a balance in the general fund, and so ultimately, programs that the state is paying for are taxpayer funded. The estimate that you're talking about was something that we underwent additional consideration with MMB after the original fiscal note back in 2023. There was just given other evidence from other states, there was a lot of hesitancy that the numbers that MMB had originally brought us were inflated. So this, we do feel that this estimate via the public programs is much closer to what the cost actually would be to the state. And then the Mercer study mentioned earlier in 2021 has shown that 97% of plans that have IVF coverage have not seen an increased cost in premiums or cost to the consumer or to the patients. So I feel pretty good about these numbers and certainly willing to consider conversations. One of the amendments that I had talked with a couple of members about today was potentially removing the public programs and then limiting this to large group only, which is certainly still a consideration. Then large group, obviously, we know in this committee covers a small sliver of Minnesotans, but something is better than nothing. And we don't estimate that there would be an increased cost in premiums to the consumer based on the small number of Minnesotans that it covers and given the evidence from 25 other states. I think that, again, hesitancy is expected, and but actuaries are pretty good at their job, and Mercer ran that study just a few years ago, and I think that given the best evidence that we have and the best information from the experts, I think that these numbers are pretty solid.
So,
Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So have you had some deep discussions with the insurance industry on this? And, you know, my belief would be is a new mandate, which is one of many in Minnesota, is going to affect, well, one, obviously we're going to, the taxpayers are going to pay a big portion of this, but also this is going to go against insurance companies and ultimately insurance companies pass the cost on down, right? That's just kind of how it works. I tell you, I spent last week in my district back home, and I heard this question asked everywhere I went. You know, our premiums have gone up 20 and 30%. Our health insurance premiums continue to rise in this state. And as you look at the number of mandates that are on our policies, well, of course, insurance is going up. Aren't residents in your district asking you about health insurance costs? I know we're going a little off subject here, but aren't they asking you about, it's a big part of their mom's and dad's budget is covering health care.
Representative Cattis-Mattoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Van Binsbergen. Yes, my constituents do have the same concerns about rising health care costs, but when we look at the numbers and the evidence that proves out there aren't increased costs for 97% of programs for an infertility coverage mandate, that's the proof is in the pudding right there, right? Like, so we can have feelings about what may happen, and we can have insurance tell us that everything that we do is going to drive up costs, but even if we do nothing, the costs are still rising. The system is broken. We know this. And so what this bill does is allow families to reach services that right now are unaffordable and allow them to build their families. And I think that, you know, we can only look at the data that we have. And to Representative Hewitt's point, we may need to explore collecting some additional data here in Minnesota, But when we look at other states, half the country has implemented a similar mandate, and that's the information that we can base our decisions off of here. So I'm definitely willing to consider other ways to limit this bill or trim the coverage back, but I think that the numbers that we have are the best estimate that we're able to do so without further Minnesota state data.
Any follow-up? I got it right twice in a row now. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. The decision when, if, and how to start a family is one of the most important, personal, maybe even sacred choices that a person, a Minnesotan, will make in their lives. And right now, for those who get a diagnosis and find out that they are struggling with infertility, that decision is about money. We are living in a society where people are not able to have children that they are desired, that they want, not because there isn't a way for them to have children, but because they are not wealthy enough to pay for something we have that allows them to have children. That is wrong. And that situation exists not because of a lack of medicine, not because of a lack of love or desire to start a family. It's because of decisions of us around this table. We have decided to maintain that situation in Minnesota. There are states where that is not the situation, where insurance does cover this. When people find out they're struggling with infertility, they can continue to be covered by their insurance plans so that they can pursue one of the most beautiful parts of human life. I don't think I've talked about this publicly. My wife and I were diagnosed with unexplained infertility a decade ago while we were living in Illinois. And we had insurance, and Illinois has mandated infertility coverage. And so we began treatments. And as many who are wearing orange in this room know, that is basically a full-time job, especially for the woman. Almost weekly appointments, a battery of tests, all kinds of medications to use. Many people experience the trauma and sorrow of miscarriage while trying these various things. It is a difficult thing. About 8 months into that, we very excitedly got a job and moved to Minnesota, where there's not this coverage on the insurance that we have. And so all of that work, all of that desire to have a child, we just couldn't move forward. We couldn't have a second mortgage, as some people were able to do. We just didn't have the money. So to hear that we don't have money to allow Minnesotans to make this important decision with insurance they have is preposterous to me. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars to attract businesses to Minnesota. Just this week, yesterday, there was a bill from a member on this committee that was asking for $10 million to attract people to Minnesota for sustainable aviation fuel, which is a area that doesn't exist and we have a tax credit for that no money has been paid out of yet. But when we talk about this bill for Minnesotan families that is much more affordable, to be able to make the decision to have a child, we don't have the money. I can't fathom this. This is a fantastic bill. Thank you, those who have come and given their stories and lent their stories to this. I want a Minnesota where people can have children, can make that decision, not because of the amount of money in their bank account, but because of the love in their heart. That's what this bill will allow Minnesotans to do, and I hope we get this done. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Katiza-Watoon, for bringing this bill forward. And back in September, my wife and I had a miscarriage, and to hear some of the testifiers talk about what is the price you would put on that, there is no price, and I get that. You know, in this committee, talking about cost, I want everybody who testified to understand that, like, it's our job to figure out what is absolutely necessary and how do you balance that cost. That's part of our job here. And when we talk about the individual market and the mandates that have been placed on the individual market over and over and over again, a lot of these mandates have been presented to us as if the cost is negligible, you know. So I appreciate you being open to the Senate amendment, talking about religious and conscientious objections as we work this bill forward and lay it over and figure out how to get it in its best form. If everything is a priority, if everything is a mandate, nothing is, you know. And for this would be a priority, I think, for me, you know. I want people to have kids and have families and be healthy. What I would be interested in is a repealer of something else that maybe, you know, maybe we kicked around 2 years ago, maybe you guys passed it 2 years ago, but we're figuring out that the cost benefit across the state of Minnesota isn't worth it. I'd be interested in working in this, something in this bill, as long as we're saying, okay, there's a balancing act here. Like, this is our, this is a priority for us. You know, what else can we look at that may be less of a priority? So I appreciate the testimony, and I would just wonder if you'd be open to something like that.
Representative Katisa-Batoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for sharing your story, Representative Reimer. I'm so sorry that you and your wife have gone through that, and to everybody else who has experienced loss in that way. That is something that I would have to consider. I mean, to look through the mandates that we do already cover here in the state of Minnesota, and kind of look at how the numbers may balance. And I mean, I think that if we were to do something like that, we would want to make sure that kind of that the estimated numbers of this coverage would line up to something else. And I'm not sure what that may be at this point in time, but I appreciate that suggestion, and I'm willing to have the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. There is no question that this is a very delicate issue for folks, and I want to put this along with other issues that we've heard in this committee into context for the committee's benefit. I've been on the Commerce Committee I think my entire legislative career, and we continue to hear about the need for coverage for new mandates and new things. And I have come to the conclusion that the number one thing that a testifier or a bill author wants with a mandate is what's in front of the committee at that point in time, because it affects people, as does this issue affect people. And Representative Katisa-Watoon, you, I think, were right in your assessment that the system is broken. And we have offered in this committee this year ways to fix that system. One of them is Representative Perryman's House File 400, which says that if the state of Minnesota determines, as I believe that Representative Smith's comments were he didn't specifically say this, but they were, I think, in the realm of, if Minnesota thinks it's an important item for people, then Minnesota should be at the table. And a way for Minnesotans to be at the table on this, to keep insurance costs in check, is to adopt House File 400. And for your benefit, members in the public that's here who haven't maybe heard what House File 400 does, House File 400 says that when the legislature requires an additional mandate, the legislature will pay the defrayal or the cost of that additional mandate, leaving it revenue neutral or cost neutral for the person who has to pay the insurance premiums. Let me say that again. For the person who has to pay the insurance premiums to get the coverage, that is now added into that policy. It's like a snowstorm. As the night snows fall, you have to shovel the driveway in the morning. Shoveling the driveway in the morning means you got to pay the bill. Representative Van Binsbergen very, very aptly pointed out that the costs of insurance are going up 20% to 30%. I continue to hear from people in my district about the cost of insurance. I have, without tire, said to this committee, if we are going to be adding mandates in, you are cutting off the bottom of the group of people who need insurance. They can't afford it at all. So the individuals who are trying desperately to help with these different mandates can't afford the insurance to get the mandate. And it's not a, well, I get to get 50% of the coverage that's in the bill, or rather in the policy provisions and limits. I get nothing. It's all or nothing. I pay the premium, and I get all the coverage that's in there, or I can't afford the premium, and I get nothing, including basic health services. So, Representative Katisa-Watoon, you are correct. The system is broken, and we have offered ideas on how to fix that system. Also, earlier this year, we talked about renewing the 1332 waiver with the federal government on our individual plans through MNsure, keeping those costs down from 20 to 30 to 40% additional premium increases. I shudder to think the conversation that this committee and this legislature is going to have in future legislative sessions if we don't actually get that passed, yes, this year, and apply for that waiver to be able to provide predictability into the future. Instead of just doing it a couple years at a time, let's do it for the five-year waiver so that the insurance companies can smooth out what the costs are going to be so that we can keep premiums affordable for Minnesotans. Madam Chair and members, thank you for your the opportunity to address this matter this morning.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. You know, hearing these stories, I had a good friend who was going through infertility at the same time that I became pregnant, and I joke I'm Irish, so it doesn't take much. But you know, I felt guilty. I felt guilt that it wasn't hard, that it was something that came easy for me and my husband. And you know, I kind of think the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And you know, I keep getting emails and having meetings with people who are losing coverage. They're losing services. And healthcare is still going up. The costs are still going up. And if we continue to just, you know, keep doing the same thing we've always done by, you know, throwing money at insurance companies, we're not going to see anything change. So, you know, I think like one of the only ways that we can get insurance companies to cover things is through mandates. That's what the Affordable Care Act did, was set a basic standard. I was uninsured before the ACA because I have a bad back. And a lot of times before the ACA, a uterus was a pre-existing condition. And so, you know, I think that we should continue to pursue that 1332 waiver, but with a different idea. You know, maybe a single risk pool with, you know, benefits that cover the health care we need at the time when we need it, so that everybody can have access to preventative care, to maybe address health issues before they discover infertility, that we can, you know, intervene at earlier ages with children when we see problems. There's a huge way that we can save money for the system, and it's not by continuing to fund insurance. And so I really thank you for bringing this bill forward, and I would hope that we can, you know, get to a point where we can get something passed. So thank you, Representative Cortese-Batun. Any final thoughts?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members, for the discussion today. We do have a lot to consider in this committee, and you know, to Representative Reimer's point, those of us that sit around this table, we do get to make the decisions and weigh the cost-benefit analysis on what would help the most Minnesotans, right? As Speaker Hartman always said, we want to do the most good for the most people. And so nothing in this bill, I want to clarify, nothing in this bill precludes people from seeking out other treatments. As the doctor had testified, there is a series of evaluations and terrible procedures that we go through. I sat through a hysterosalpingogram, and it was one of the worst experiences of my life to ensure that my fallopian tubes were not blocked before continuing on a treatment. And so all of those things can still happen in order. This is just kind of this last step, this last hurdle, that if you've tried other things and they haven't worked, IVF is the most effective fertility treatment that we have up to this point. And right now it is out of reach for so many Minnesotans. I also, you know, want to just say that I am open to input. I'm not expecting you to do my work for me. I have come to members of the committee yesterday and today, other conversations with suggested amendments. I want to earn your buy-in. I want to get to a point, Representative Hewitt, where we have that Minnesota data. I think possibly moving forward with just a large group mandate would allow us to collect data on Minnesotans and potentially look at expansion down the line. Representative Reimer, if you've already reviewed the mandates and you've got some suggestions as to what might be a trade-off, I'm willing to have those conversations. And I'm willing to do the work. I'm not saying that this bill is perfect and that you have to bring suggestions to me in order to get your support for it, but I would like to have a conversation. So I'm willing to bring forward ideas, and I would hope that you would do the same, and really hope that we can do some good work together to make sure that we can become the best place in the country to raise a family and one of the best places to start a family. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, I will lay House File 1758 over for possible inclusion. Next on the agenda, House File 4437, Representative Greenman. We went a little over on time on that one, but I thought it was a good discussion. So we might need to keep the next few tight on time. So. Welcome to the committee, Representative Greenman. I will move House File 4437 with the intent to lay the bill over. I understand you have an A4 amendment. Will you please explain the amendment?
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. The A4 amendment is based on a lot of work and input that has come both from the alcohol and gambling enforcement folks, as well as work with the Senate and other stakeholders. In addition to some minor conforming and sort of grammar changes to match up with the Senate, it moves the cease and desist order function from the AG's office to the AGE. It adds additional specificity to the section that outlines what activities are prohibited, and it condenses the prohibition on advertising related to the illegal conduct.
Any discussion to the A4 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. All right, Representative Greenman, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 4437 bans the operating, hosting, and advertising of prediction market gambling in Minnesota. And as this committee well knows, the regulation of gambling has long been considered the province of state, tribal, and local governments. And this bill preserves that in Minnesota. So what are prediction markets and why are they a problem? Prediction markets are platforms not regulated by the state that allow people to bet on the outcomes of future events. Markets are operated by companies like Kalshi, Polymarket, Fanatics, Crypto.com. They set up a series of binary contracts that allow people to bet and get paid out based on the outcome of an event. These gambling markets allow users to anonymously bet on future events. For example, last night I checked Polymarket. You could bet on whether Iran will strike the East-West crude oil pipeline by April 30th. Will SpaceX have an IPO by September 30th? Will Jesus Christ return before 2027? And the outcome of pretty much any sporting event or in-game event that could be happening that you could think of. These platforms make money by charging a bettor a fee, bringing together users and the opposite side of the bet. They also operate clearing houses that settle the bets and often participate in betting with their own so-called trading arms. This has caused an explosion of gambling in the last year without any regulations and safeguards that the state has been putting in place around gambling for years. In Minnesota, similar to states around the country, betting and gambling has been tightly regulated. State and tribal regulators have worked for decades to build transparent and effective systems to license and regulate gambling. And since I have been in the legislature, there has been a robust conversation about whether to expand sports betting in Minnesota, and if we did, how we would regulate it to ensure robust consumer protections, ensure revenue collection, responsible gaming measures, and efforts to deal with problem gambling. There are members supporting this bill that are on both sides of the issue of whether or not we should expand sports betting in Minnesota. Because there's broad consensus here that whether Minnesota does or does not expand sports betting, how we do it, if we did it, should be our decision in Minnesota to make. These prediction markets skirt that law, and they circumvent state authority and our own Minnesota laws governing gambling. They functionally create an unregulated sports book and a way to bet on almost anything. This is exactly how these platforms have been advertising themselves. Kalshi was running ads calling them the first nationwide legal sports betting platform. And they're doing it without any of the consumer protections, without the age restrictions to 21-year-olds without anti-money laundering protections and with no effort to deal with problem gambling. And as we're seeing more and more with, and the Wall Street Journal reported, prediction markets are leading to a trend of teenage gambling, which can have a particularly adverse impact on younger gamblers and teenagers. In addition to circumventing state regulations on gambling, prediction markets open up placing bets on almost anything from elections, wars, to disasters. And by allowing anonymous bets on war, policy, and cases, it creates an enormous ethics concern. It also makes these markets vulnerable to cheating and manipulation by anonymous insiders. And you've probably all read the news about recently largely time suspicious bets about world events that are raising real concerns that people are betting with non-public information and market manipulation for private gain. And many experts warn that as these prediction markets grow, we will start to see behavior that changes events in response to this betting. These markets create this type of shadowy financial self-dealing that threatens to corrupt sports, politics, foreign policy, and so much more. And Minnesota is not alone. States around the country, red states, blue states, are responding to these prediction markets by bringing law enforcement action. And that's what this legislation does. It allows us to protect our current regulatory framework in Minnesota by defining what prediction markets are and outlawing them, making them a felony to create, operate, or facilitate a prediction market or advertise an illegal prediction market. And it allows the AGE to send cease and desist orders to make sure people aren't doing that behavior. It includes exemptions to preserve the current framework for legal gambling and insurance markets and all the things that are currently legal and regulated. And it ensures that in Minnesota, we do not allow this unregulated explosion of gambling on almost anything.
Thank you. With that, we will move to testifiers. First up on the agenda is Annette Thomas Meeks, followed by Leah Patton. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Co-Chair O'Driscoll, members of the committee, for allowing me to testify on behalf of Citizens Against Gambling Expansion, a Minnesota nonprofit organization that I've been a member of for 15 years. We fought many different iterations of gambling expansion in our state. This is a unique one, and I'm just thrilled to be here next to Representative Greenman. You know, there's probably in this heated day of high partisanship not much that we agree on. We solidly agree on this one, and I'm thrilled to be here with you. Prediction markets are the Wild West of gambling. It's virtually unregulated, should be considered illegal under Minnesota's existing gambling laws. Recent polling showed us that only 21% of Americans polled had even ever heard of Kalshi, Poly Market, two of the largest prediction markets. Yet these web-based sites reportedly are worth $18 billion in wagers in recent years. For those of you unfamiliar about how prediction markets work, Representative Greenman gave you a great oversight, but they've emerged as a way for gamblers to wager on also ignoble occurrences, such as predicting the death of famous individuals, when or if the Federal Reserve Bank will cut interest rates, or most recently, the likelihood of finding Savannah Guthrie's mother. It's truly ghastly. Prediction market platforms have entered mobile sports betting here in Minnesota quite brazenly. I hear the ads every day on WCCO radio where sports gambling still remains illegal. They've done this because they understand they've seen the lucrative numbers of getting 18-year-olds and younger become associated with the sports betting industry, and they want to cut of that action. It's estimated today that 90% of all activity on the Kalshi website is sports-related. There are a multitude of reasons that, in order to be brief here today, state gambling regulators are you. You, the legislature, must step in. This is purposeful workaround that these companies have done to work around existing state law in Minnesota. But one of the most important reasons is that they currently exist. These prediction markets lack any appropriate state oversight, regulation, nor do they offer any state-provided consumer protection. Unlike state-sponsored gambling, such as our lottery, tribal casinos, other legal and regulated forms of gambling, prediction markets are unregulated. They pay zero in state taxes, zero in regulatory fees, and that means the state receives zero revenue from prediction markets. But yet, the state and all 87 counties are left to handle the social pathologies left behind, especially by the teenagers that are becoming addicted to these things. Finally, I'd like to add that every country in the world considers prediction markets to be a form of gambling. It's only in the United States where these gambling platforms exist with a wink and a nod. They hide behind twisted wording and yet allow high school students to place wagers on the Super Bowl or most recently the March Madness lineup and then say, oh, but we're not sports betting. Regardless of what they call themselves, prediction markets are and have become a major form of online sports gambling in Minnesota, and you're doing the right thing here today by joining dozens of other states stopping this illegal form of sports betting. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Next up is Leah Patton. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members, my name is Leah Patton. I'm Executive Director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, and I'm here to testify in favor of House File 4437. So the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition is a statewide advocacy group formed through the partnership of our three sponsoring faith organizations, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas, and the Minnesota Council of Churches. So as people of faith, we advocate alongside our neighbors of different religious backgrounds to address poverty, uphold the dignity of overlooked communities, mitigate societal harm, and promote social justice. Online gambling is not legal in Minnesota. However, prediction markets offer a loophole for unregulated online gambling and sports betting. Trading on these markets takes place on an incredible range of outcomes, from when a ceasefire between Iran and the United States would be reached, when it would be reached, if a war was officially going to be declared in Venezuela and when that would be, to whether the price of a can of Arizona iced tea will increase within this calendar year. So the ability to bet on basically any outcome, combined with the online nature of these markets, provides a nearly unlimited amount of opportunities to wager and lose significant amounts of money. This presents a significant danger to those at risk of developing compulsive gambling behaviors, particularly young people, as Representative Greenman touched on. Recent studies show that approximately 6% of college students have a serious gambling problem. Prediction market companies understand how susceptible young people, specifically young men, are to falling prey to this thinly disguised form of online gambling. Companies specifically target platforms and online spaces frequented by teenagers and young adults, like online streaming platforms and social media, for advertising. There are examples of prediction market companies contracting underage influencers. The specific example I'm thinking about is the influencer was 15 years old, to advertise their markets to their young audiences. Numerous lawsuits and regulatory actions have identified the predatory practices of these markets, and we know who they're preying upon. The most well-known prediction market, Kalshi, recently indicated that they plan to block athletes, coaches, and officials, sporting officials, from trading on their sports. This move is essentially a confession that prediction markets themselves are not confused regarding the service they provide, which is online sports betting and gambling. I'd also like to touch briefly on something that Representative Greenman alluded to and Representative Hollins in a different committee alluded to on this bill, which is the moral problem of wagering on events that destroy families, destroy communities, sometimes obliterate communities, destroy lives. Atrocities, wars, natural disasters. What does that do to a society to have people incentivized and financially benefiting from those things? I can tell you it's nothing good. And I think that's something that should also be included in this conversation. So Minnesotans rely on all of you as their elected officials to determine what regulations are needed on gambling in Minnesota, not the CEOs of multi-billion dollar trading companies with essentially no accountability for the steep societal cost that their platforms impose on our communities. So we urge you to vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We also have Phil Brodeen to answer questions, if anybody has any. So any members of the public wishing to testify?
Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Any discussion? Representative Davids. Chair Davids.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And Representative Greenman, thanks for visiting with me the other day regarding this. I'm a co-author of the bill. I wish this would have been in about 4 weeks ago so we could get this thing moving. It's a great bill, but of course I'm kind of a stickler on deadlines and so forth. But this bill makes all the sense in the world. This is a huge, huge expansion of gaming and unregulated. And I think eventually we can, hopefully we can all support the Greenman bill and get it moving forward. I don't know if it's next year, if there would be amendment pop up on the floor, or, you know, something like that. So thank you very much for all your work on this. It's a great bill.
Thank you. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually do agree, even though I'm the resident crazy libertarian, that prediction markets should be regulated. Absolutely agree. Unfortunately, it's not for us to do so. I mean, just last week, an appellate court ruled in favor of the prediction markets in a lawsuit. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission is suing three states who are trying to do something similar. And if we move forward on this, we're just going to increase litigation costs for our state. No doubt, I expect those cases to move up the chain to the Supreme Court, and perhaps they would rule that the states have the right to regulate it. Until that happens, all we're doing is engendering taxpayers to pay for litigation costs that we very likely will lose if any recent court case is determining it. People do enjoy these things, and I hate making things illegal that people are currently doing. However, I do agree that we need regulations around it, especially considering some of the stories that we've seen. With one thing that's very good about prediction markets is they actually are pretty good at predicting things when people have monetary skin in the game. I can see the argument for targeting this to sports and athletic events and those kind of things, because who cares if we predict that? And banning, like, as I've been previously mentioned, betting on people's deaths or buying contracts on people's death, that's pretty gross. But it does provide, actually particularly in politics, a more accurate picture than what we see in other things. And I think that's a valuable thing for the public to have access to. So moving forward, if we do have the authority to regulate this, would the author be open to tailoring it more to a sports betting type athletic events and the most gross type of contracts, if we do have the authority? I'd be wondering if the author would consider those, and I probably don't need to follow up.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate Representative West. You're right, this is... there's a circuit split. There are cases in that will end up in the Supreme Court. I think that there are 22 or more states that are trying to assert their what has always been known authority of states to regulate gambling. I think that that is a both red states, blue states, purple states all have had that common understanding. These prediction markets really disrupt that and circumvent that. So I think that Minnesota, like those other states who are both using regulatory legislative efforts and litigation, should protect our ability to both regulate gambling and protect our citizens from what you heard was a public health and ethical and also regulatory obligation that we have. I think that I actually think that the question of sports betting is, again, something that I have actually not been that involved in that conversation. But there has been a long, robust conversation, and many of you in this room have had a lot of conversations about it. I don't know why we would subvert that conversation. Minnesota should decide whether we want to expand online sports betting and in general. I think all of these other kinds of things, and as you heard Ms. Patton say, the idea that we would allow people to bet on the finding the kidnapped mother of a celebrity, that we would allow people to bet on whether or not a country will get bombed, that we would allow people to bet on policy decisions that members of Congress are making, and because these markets are anonymous, you don't know if lawmakers are participating or some or a spouse of a lawmaker are participating and they have inside information. The idea of insider wagering, the idea of anonymous betting is a really, really nefarious thing. And so I am interested and open to all conversations, but the idea, all of those other things that you said, I don't think we should be, or I think that you sort of would constrain out of this bill, I think raise huge ethical and moral and legal concerns that we would want to deal with.
Thank you. Representative Reimer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greenman, if you could, just because I know we've stated a few times prediction markets, like, and I think we've outlined how in this committee how it seems like it's betting. My understanding about prediction markets is it's kind of based on securities and futures laws, and you know, this seems to like deviate from that. What is the technical, how do they get away with this technically, just for the committee's information, for my own ignorance, like what is the technical thing that they do to make this not betting?
So I'm going to take a crack at this and maybe pull up an expert, but let me start and you should come up here, Phil. So the reason that this is, and I think that as you heard from Ms. Meeks, is that in every other country in the world, they consider this betting because these are binary yes, no agreements. I think that one of the main differences that they say is instead of having a house, you have contracts and you have a wagering between two people. Now, I think that the way that they set this up, and again, these platforms have trading arms that are getting on the other side of the bets. They're bringing in third parties, and they are also facilitating the transaction. I think it starts to be impossible to do what you just said was how you distinguish it. But let me turn it over to the expert.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil Brodeen. So the way that this works is that up until recently, these prediction markets had been used for typical commodities type things. In 2014, 2015, we saw a shift in allowing what kind of bets are allowed on those platforms. So no longer is it strictly related to your bread and butter commodities. Now it's opened up to binary yes and no questions on nearly everything under the sun. One important thing to note, Kelshi, the Arabic translation for Kelshi is everything. That's what they want to bet on. So we saw a definite shift in what kind of markets were being offered. And importantly, under the federal law, the Commodities Exchange Act, it allows these folks on these markets to self-certify what kind of bets they do. So there's no real front-end review of what bets get placed, and that's kind of the shift that we've seen. So early last year, we saw we're opening up, you know, there were advertisements. We're opening up, first of all, it was sports betting in 50 wide states, right? After that went down a little the road and then into litigation, they started to say it's only trading. We're offering trading in all 50 states. So the distinct shift was earlier when they opened up the markets to sports, war, disasters, those types of things. One important thing on the circuit, that was an astute point that was made. There are 13 federal circuits in the country. So that case came out of the Third Circuit. It's located in Philadelphia. There will be further litigation in the Fourth and the Ninth Circuit. So ultimately, if this question of preemption gets decided, it will be by the Supreme Court. But the upshot is that I don't think the state of Minnesota or the Minnesota legislature should wait or take all that much guidance from a court based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The decisions here are different. The gaming laws are different and everything. In fact, we don't even have an existing case in the Eighth Circuit for this type of issue. So I hope that helps and provides clarity.
Thank you so much. We do have another bill on the calendar, and this one will be laid over. I have three other on the list, so if we could just make them quick, I would really appreciate that. Representative Buck.
Madam Mayor, thank you. First, thank you for bringing this forward. As someone who was probably worked on one of the first sports betting bills for the tribes. It's really disheartening that this bill hasn't gone through or even has any type of opposition whatsoever, knowing the amount of things that I have heard come out of this body, maybe not particularly these individuals, but this body over the last 10 years, almost 10 years that I've worked on the sports betting bill myself. I haven't been part of it in the last probably 4 years now. But it's really disheartening that there would be anybody that would have a problem with this, with the things that have been said and the issues that we had as tribes trying to get a legalized bill through that actually helped not only the state, the track, racetrack, and the charities. excuse me. So thank you again for bringing this forward. I have no questions. I just wanted to thank you and to remind everyone of the issues and the concerns that they had with the sports betting bill that we tried to bring forward and continue to try to bring forward, and also try to apply those same things to this bill. Badamayaya, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I want to clarify something very clean. Referees in the state of Minnesota do not bet on sports betting, just to make that clear in the
room.
At least
one.
however, saying that, though, I think that we're always about rules. And Representative Davis, Chair Davis, I totally understand where you're coming from. And again, being a rule guy myself, I know that deadlines mean something, but I think deadlines are guidelines, so maybe we can get this through this year. And I'm going to say something that, Chair Davis would know is when Tony Boza was in charge, because he's probably, him and I are the only ones in this room that were not in high school, he said, you have to put a brake on poll tabs, and at that time we did. And that's so important because even though I am big on the sports betting bill because my constituents want it, those guys that are in the basement betting on bills, they want it. This here is something that we cannot control. I don't think we should worry about what the courts are going to do. We as a state need to control this, and that's why I think that when we look at sports betting, we have relationships with the tribes, we have relationships with the services, we can control that, we can turn the button on and off like we did in poll tabs a few times. I really think that this is an area that we're not in control of and all the gross things that are coming out of this, and so, but I want to make it clear that I don't bet on sports gambling, so thank you.
Thank you. Representative Allen.
Real quick, thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, could the last testifier please state your name and the organization or group that you're here representing, please?
Oh, Phil Brodine.
Yeah, I'm Phil Brodine. I'm legal counsel for the Shakopee Mittewakan Sioux community.
Thank you. Representative Davids.
Thank you very much, since my name was invoked. deadlines are deadlines. They are not guidelines. They are not suggestions. I suggest any member of this committee go back to when my DFL friends were in the minority, going very severely after Speaker Dowd about deadlines, and that deadlines are deadlines. And if you don't think deadlines are deadlines, I just suggest you watch John Wick 1.
I've also heard that there was a quote attributed to you, Chair Davids, that deadlines don't apply to you, though.
That is correct.
Got it. Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greenman, during today's testimony and the presentation of this bill, I've pulled together a few thoughts. Number one, you are bringing up a kind of an interesting topic, which took me to an auxiliary topic that I think that I'd like to just toss out to you for consideration. You and I have worked together on different things, and you said, it'd be really kind of nice if you and I could work on a bill together. Have I got an idea for you this morning? Why don't you and I work on a bill and see if we can't get it into law this year that our congressional delegation from the state of Minnesota cannot act on insider information that they see in Congress? Doesn't look like Congress is getting going on it, but this is something that I think that everyone in this committee could agree on, and if you're going to represent the state of Minnesota, you need to do it clean and without bias. Get the bill ready. I'll author it with you. We'll go to rules together to get a waiver.
Representative Greenman.
Representative O'Driscoll, I would love to work on that bill with you, and I would love to meet with Chair Davids to over his opposition based on the rules.
Thank you. Representative Greenman, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate this conversation. I think the reason that we should act with urgency, and I understand we're laying it over here, it'll move forward in the Senate, and so I hope we have an opportunity to do it this year, is because in the last year, we have seen the explosion of this, and I do think if we wait another year, another however long it is, it will, the negative public health impacts on teenagers particularly, but also the disruption that it has to our legal framework that we regulate gambling on will be pretty extreme. So I'm hoping that we can figure out a way to both ban insider information being used in Congress and also ban these prediction markets that are really dangerous, I think, for the public.
Thank you. And with that, we will lay the bill over as amended. House file. Is that right? We're good? Okay. Next up is Representative Tabke with House File 4353, and I will move this bill before us with the intent to lay it over as well. As you're making your way up there, members, there is an A26 amendment in your packet, so I will move the A26. And Rep. Tabke, if you would like to explain the amendment.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The amendment takes, and the number one thing that, from my perspective, the amendment does is this bill is handling how ADW, so Advanced Deposit Wagering, happens at Canary Park and Running Aces in the state of Minnesota. And so with this, it takes and makes sure that this money that we are trying to raise here goes straight to purses, which goes to support workers in Shakopee and making sure that we are able to have a thriving industry.
Thank you. All those in, or is there any discussion to the A26? All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Tabke, if you'd like to explain your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members and Chair O'Driscoll. So Canterbury Park is in Shakopee in my district, and Canterbury Park is extremely important, a pillar of our community, making sure that we are having a thriving racing industry. As if anybody's been to Canterbury Park or to Shakopee, over the course of the last couple of years, you've seen a lot of changes and a lot of work being done there to make sure that we are that we have a restaurant district and we have a lot of things going on around this area, as well as the thousands of workers who are working at Canterbury Park. And so the horse racing industry is struggling right now, and we need to make sure that for my community and making sure that for our industry, which is not just the horse racing itself in Shakopee, it expands into significant ag ramifications if this were to have problems, and the veterinary area and large animal vets and those kinds of things. And so what this bill would do would be, currently Minnesota is one of there are 39 states in the United States that allow for advanced deposit wagering, and so Minnesota is the only state in the nation that doesn't allow you to bet on races that are happening in your community. So if you think about it, a really good way to think about this is, like, if Vikings games, there are blackouts for Vikings games, and people who want to be able to be racing and people who want to be able to be betting on racing aren't able to, it's like Minnesota is blacked out for these racing opportunities. And so it's a what it would do is it would make sure that we are able to bet in state here in the state of Minnesota and make sure that people who enjoy racing and want to be betting on racing are able to do that. And 100% with the amendment, 100% of this money would go to the racing industry. And so it would go toward the folks that are doing all the work on a day-to-day basis, because we need to make sure that we are improving the purses in the state of Minnesota. And we've got a couple of different testifiers here, Madam Chair, that we could go for.
Thank you. We have 7 minutes left, so I hope we can get them all in. First on the agenda is Tom DePasquale. I'm sorry, I totally butchered that, I'm sure.
I was very close.
Okay, good. And probably not at all. And then next up is Randy Sampson. So if you could just get on deck here, and then welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank
with
you,
your
Madam Chair. My name is Tom DePasquale. I was formerly executive director of the Minnesota Racing Commission from 2013 to 2020. After I retired from the Racing Commission, I've been functioning as a consultant to the Federal Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority, which exercises preemptive authority over all racetrack safety and medication testing at racetracks all over the country. I was there at the present at the birth of this bill in 2016 when it was passed, and I want to thank Co-Chair O'Driscoll for his support of the bill. Representative Davids was a co-author of the bill. It had bipartisan support at the time. It was supported by the leadership of the Senate and House Commerce Committees, the Labor, Agricultural, and Rural Development Committees, and it was done for the purpose of helping to sustain and help the racing industry and all the attendant business that goes with it, the economic impact in the state, thrive. The reason that in-state wagering on Minnesota racetracks was not part of the original bill is it was simply a function of a political compromise at the time. And as Representative Tapke said, with 39 states authorizing advanced deposit wagering, we're the only ones who prohibit Minnesotans from wagering on races in their own state. So the problem with that is that although the ADW bill statute has provided a lot of money for the racing industry, the breeding industry over time, and has helped to sustain it, the fact of the matter is that of the several hundred million dollars that have been wagered on ADW since 2016, not $1 has been wagered on Minnesota races. So we are placing an impediment, unlike every other state in the country, in front of the growth and support of our own industry. And as Representative Tappy said, we're essentially blacking out Minnesotans from wagering on their own races. So with that, I will defer to Mr. Sampson to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions afterwards.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sampson, if you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Chair O'Driscoll, my name is Randy Sampson. I'm the chairman and CEO of Canterbury Park. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here on behalf of Canterbury in support of House File 4353. Since 2016, the Minnesota horse racing industry has benefited from the ADW bill that brought Minnesota statutes in line with federal law and allowed racing fans to bet on races conducted in other states through advanced deposit wagering. Using your computer, tablet, or phone, you can make bets on the same races as you would if you were at Canterbury Park or Running Aces. As mentioned, Minnesota is the only state that allows ADW that restricts it to wagering only on out-of-state races. This proposed change to the ADW law serves two purposes. It provides a way for racing fans to bet on local live racing without having to drive to the racetrack, and it provides additional revenues to support purses for Minnesota's live racing. ADW wagering in Minnesota has generated over $2 million a year for purses, racetrack operations, and regulatory fees. This bill is intended to help address the primary challenge facing Minnesota, which is providing competitive purse levels needed to attract horse breeders, owners, and trainers to support Minnesota racing. The states that continue to be success stories in racing are those that find ways to support higher purses for their racetrack. Minnesota competes with other racing states to attract horses for breeding and racing. When other states find ways to supplement purses, they see the benefits of the thousands of people who work in and around the horse industry and a significant economic and agricultural impact. On the other hand, as purses at Canterbury have declined over the last few years, we have seen the economic benefits of what was once a thriving industry decline. Just a few years ago, we hosted over 1,100 horses to our barn area for the 2022 race meet. In 2025, that number was down to about 700 horses. Extending ADW to in-state racing will not be a complete solution to the problem, but it will take a step in the right direction, adding an estimated $600,000 each year for racing purses. Also, as other states have shown, this is an important way to keep our racing fans who don't live close to the racetracks involved in our local racing product. This legislation will help to fuel interest throughout the state in our Minnesota racing. As Representative Tabke can attest, the current structure has been a source of considerable complaints and consternation from our racing fans, as they can't understand why they can bet remotely on tracks throughout the country but not on their home track. They would very much appreciate the opportunity to participate in and support local horse racing instead of seeing their wagering dollars support out-of-state racing interests. This bill is common sense and simply allows Minnesota racing fans to bet on Canterbury Park races in the same way they can currently bet on races from Kentucky, New York, Florida, California,
et cetera. I'm
going to
have to ask you to wrap up. We only have 2 minutes left, and we have one
more
test fire.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you.
Anyway, I do, along with the Minnesota horse industry, we support this bill and ask that it would receive the support of legislature this year, as our industry needs to find ways to supplement purses to be successful.
Thank you very much. And last up is Sally Mixon. This bill will be laid over, and so I want to make sure to get the testifiers in, and then we can have discussion at a later date. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Mixon. If you could just state your name for the record, and if you can do your testimony in under a minute, it'd be
really
awesome.
Quick. Okay. I'm Sally Mixon.
Thank you.
I am a backsider. That means I work in the barns at Canterbury Park. I'm an exercise rider, so I gallop 6 days a week, or 6 days a week, sometimes seven, and I'm also the chaplain. I've heard over the years this this ideology that when purses increase, rich owners get richer. And that's just not the case at all. The people that are really being affected by this is the backsiders, the people that are up at 4:30 in the morning, the people that for some of them have risked everything to make a life here in the U.S. I think it's so important that people here understand that when purses decrease, it's not a hobby, it's not a sport to the backsider. It's their livelihood that's being affected. And I know there's only 200 to 300 of us. I get that. We're pretty insignificant. But all of you here, I believe, have a duty, and you're way more significant than us, to hear our voice and to be our voice, because the voice of the backsider is often not heard, and it's filled with minorities, people that have come to this country and are making an incredible living, doing something that they're passionate about. So I would encourage you all, if you haven't been back there, come back there. I will bring you, I will meet you, and see really what this sport is about, because it's so much more than racing.
Thank you.
30 seconds?
You're great. Perfect. And having a sister-in-law who's a horse person, I know that you guys are a kind of a weird breed up there.
got
a lot going with the horses. So I really do appreciate you bringing this bill. Any final thoughts, Representative Tapke, before we wrap up?
Thank you, Chairs Cagle and Driscoll, for hearing this, and thank you to Representative Witte for all of the support and help in this bill.
Wonderful. With that, I will lay House File 4353 over as amended. And this meeting is adjourned.